I started this series on how we got our Bible. In preparation for a statement we want to make downtown, I think it's something you should know about, just so you can look in the mirror of your own commitments and ask if you have an attitude of worship for God's Word, like those that made it possible for us to have access to God's Word, is the case today. Men like Tyndale shame the average Christian. I also felt like you should know what I've been teaching to counterbalance the airhead posture of those that cram their warped doctrines down your throat and then justify it by saying, "Don't you believe in the inerrant word of God?" I teach you don't have to park your brain at the door of the church to come in if it's a right church. And the more you know about God's workings, and the more you study in any area of genuine truth, the more you will come to respect God and His workings. But the practical immediate desire was to give you an educational background for the statement we intend to make in the foyer of our new home, half a block and three stories of it, to slap the devil as we make the statement downtown, "Forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven," with the finest Bible museum or display case in the heart of this great city. Our mission is to demand attention to God's Word. And better yet, to command attention by the way we do it. That's why I feel God has given us a cathedral that we're restoring. We're on the walk. And this might interest you. This is maybe the most powerful agency for preservation in the city of Los Angeles. They gained their reputation first by literally stopping the bulldozers from tearing down the Wiltern Theater on Wilshire. They're now taking on Los Angeles United School District, receives failing grades for ambassador demolition. They helped to save Pershing Square. They're strong and they're powerful, led by a PhD, trained, dedicated preservationist, Jay Round. And it's nice to be on their passing grade list, since the Los Angeles School District is failing grades. This is their current magazine. Get the title. Dr. Gene Scott is renovating the United Artists Theater. New Historic Theaters Committee formed by L.A. Conservancy. The marquee of the United Artists Theater on Broadway displays the message, "Miracle on Broadway welcomes Dr. Gene Scott." And indeed, a miracle of sorts is occurring at this historic theater. For most of its 6 decades, the United Artists has been Broadway's bad luck theater, enduring repeated periods of closure or poor attendance. Now, thanks to Dr. Scott and his university cathedral, the faded theater is undergoing a loving and careful revitalization. Dr. Scott's involvement with the theater began early this year when Bruce Corwin, president of Metropolitan Theaters, concluded that the company could not continue to operate the theater as a movie house. Because of his stated commitment to preserve the large movie palaces, he found a kindred soul in Dr. Gene Scott who appreciated the theater's grandeur. The deal was soon concluded, and Dr. Scott mobilized a small army of volunteers to begin the process of revitalization. No height was too high and no detail too minor for this dedicated corps. Mirrors now shine, lights unlit for years glow anew, and peeling paint is scraped and primed, awaiting careful matching by artisans. Even the center dome of the ceiling has been cleaned and relamped. This last task required a fearless volunteer to be hoisted up to the ceiling, dangling high above the auditorium while cleaning the dome and its famous crystals. Dr. Scott has stated that his goal is to restore the theater to its original glory. To assist in this, he has consulted with restoration experts from the A.T. Heinsberg and Company, who are preparing plans to repair and restore the large murals on each side of the auditorium. These murals were originally done by Anthony Heinsbergen in 1927. The company has also given advice on matching the lobby's original paint colors. On the exterior is the newly lighted tower, visible for many miles at night. Plans call for the theater to be ready for church services by November. Dr. Scott's interest in history and preservation is not new. A history major in college, he generously supported operation of the Southwest Museum History Library, has restored his own historic house as well as other commercial buildings. Los Angeles Conservancy members interested in seeing the transformation of the United Artists Theater need not wait for the November opening, as Dr. Scott has generously allowed our Saturday morning Broadway theater tours to walk through this work in progress. Now, a picture of the Grand United Artists Theater was modeled after Spanish Gothic cathedrals. Now, the least you can do is make sure we don't have a marathon this month. And not the least of the attractions is the Bible Museum we intend to put in the half-block-long cathedral lobby. Now, most of you know I was able to obtain yesterday in New York City the vellum leaf as well as the first whole Greek Bible containing Erasmus' New Testament, printed 2 years after Erasmus did his testament. Some of you have never seen a vellum leaf. We don't have a Gutenberg. We've got a Gutenberg leaf now. But I'll give you a little idea of what vellum leaves look like. This is a That's a little older than Gutenberg. This is a 13th century Biblia Sacra, Latin Bible, Jerome's Vulgate, vellum leaves. That's sheepskin. You're aware of that. How many didn't know vellum was sheepskin? Put the camera. How many of you did not know vellum was sheepskin? Well, now you do. Now look at this hand script. This is before Gutenberg. This is hand scripted vellum work. So, to give you a little idea of what a vellum leaf looks like, there's a... You're on live, Joe. I guess you don't know it. There's a 13th century, that's between 12 and 1300 A.D. At least 300 plus years before Gutenberg invented type. Latin Bible, which will be in the predecessors of our English Bible, section on display. I have no idea what that's worth, considering the way things went at the auction at Sotheby's yesterday and the day before. We'll come back to that. I'd like to continue teaching on how we got our English Bible. The days following Tyndale. You ready? Still reading from Fire and Blood. In every parish church in England stands an English Bible, whose frontpiece alone is sufficient to tell of the marvelous change that has taken place in the meantime. The design is by Holbein. In the first compartment, the Almighty is seen in the clouds with outstretched arms. Two scrolls proceed out of his mouth to the right and to the left. On the former is the phrase, "The word which goeth forth from me shall not return to me empty, but shall accomplish whatsoever I will have done." The other is addressed to King Henry. Knowing Tyndale paid with his life, this design is amazing. The other phrase on the second scroll proceeding from the Almighty in this design on the Bible that is in every parish church in England. The second scroll is addressed to King Henry, who is kneeling in the distance bareheaded with his crown lying at his feet. "I have found me a man after mine own heart, who shall fulfill all my will." Henry answers, "Thy word is a lantern unto my feet." Immediately below is the king seated on his throne, holding in each hand the book on which it is written, the Word of God. This he is giving to Cranmer and another bishop, who with a group of priests are on the right of the picture, saying, "Take this and teach." The other on the opposite side he holds out to Cromwell and the lay peers, and the words are, "I will make a decree that in all my kingdom men shall tremble in fear before the living God," while a third scroll, falling downward over his feet, speaks alike to peer and prelate, "Judge righteous judgment, turn not away your ear from the prayer of any poor man." In the third compartment, Cranmer and Cromwell are distributing the Bibles to kneeling priests and laymen, and at the bottom, a preacher with a benevolent and beautiful face is addressing a crowd from a pulpit in the open air. He is apparently commencing his sermon with the words, "I exhort, therefore, that all, first of all, supplications, prayers, thanksgiving be made for all men for kings." And at the word "kings," the people are shouting, "Vivat Rex!" Children who know no Latin lisping, "God save the king." While at the extreme left, a prisoner at a jail window is joining in the cry of delight, as if he too were delivered from a worse bondage. This was the so-called Great Bible of 1539, the first English authorized version. Now, to those that are tuned in the first time tonight, this will not have as much impact. But when you think of the price that Tyndale had to pay to get the scriptures in English, now, 3 years after Tyndale being burned at the stake, cries out, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." Just 3 years later, there is a so-called Great Bible of 1539, the first English authorized version. It was indeed a marked change that had passed over England. The Reformation was gaining ground among clergy and laity. Henry had openly broken with the Pope. And we showed you the other night that in our museum we'll have the only other copy. The only other copy in these United States. Say that again slowly. The only other copy in these United States . Five states of this great text are identified, all assigned to 1536. Now, the Great Bible comes out in 1539. Tyndale, having been a martyr at about the same time, and there are circumstantial evidences that Tyndale had influence on the 10 articles that separated the British church from Rome. Perhaps the most important church document in English history. The famous 10 articles submitted to Henry VIII to his parliament in 1536, the acceptance of which established an independent church in England. And get around behind me, Joe. Not that way. I don't care any way you want to go, as long as you don't make me nervous by dragging cords over these priceless books. Boy, I would be a cranky curator of a library. I mean, you'd learn to respect books around me or you'd be bouncing on your ass. The 10 articles submitted by Henry VIII to his parliament in 1536, the acceptance of which established an independent church in England. Now, you can focus all you want. Does he know? I'll tell you when to take a picture. I like being sick. I don't even have to worry about being cranky. These are the famous 10 articles submitted by Henry VIII to his parliament in 1536, the acceptance of which established an independent church in England. 5 states, that is, printing states, of this great text are identified, all assigned to 1536, and all save one are unique. 5 separate printings, and 4 of the 5 have only one example. Setting B, one of the 5, has 3 copies. Setting E, one of the 5, completely reset, is at Yale only. And when this expertizing certificate was written up, the only copy in any form of these 10 articles outside of England. Well, Yale had that distinction until now. Here is the other copy. The preface, Henry VIII, you can take a picture now. By the grace of God, King of England and of France, Defender of the Faith, Lord of Ireland. And this separated by these 10 articles adopted by Parliament, the principal articles concerning the faith, that effectively separated the Church of England from the Roman Catholic dominion. As I said, there are only 5 settings of this, 4 settings unique, 1 setting having 3 copies, of which this is one. Meaning there's a total of 7 in existence. This is one of the 7, and one of the 2 to be seen in the United States. One at Yale University, the other at the University Cathedral Library. Dr. Jean Scott Library at the University Cathedral, however you want to reference it. And with this separation from the Roman Catholic Church and the voting of the 10 articles, the Reformation was receiving more acceptance. And there seemed no disposition anywhere to oppose the desire for a people's Bible. But the opposition to William Tyndale still remained. His writings had already been publicly condemned, and the men who had condemned him and placed a ban upon his works were resolved that his Bible should never be the Bible of England. Ego. When people take a stand, they'll fight harder for what they said after they said it than they would for the same thing if they hadn't said it. Yet, in spite of their ego and attitude, this great Bible, the authorized one of 1539, and thus the authorized version of the entire nation, was virtually Tyndale's. I have a basic requirement of people who work for me. I came here 14 years ago, and I told you that some many weeks ago when I terminated everybody. With a bunch of hotshot grandstand quarterbacks sitting up in the crow's nest that had supervised the running up of a $3.5 million debt and the destruction of a ministry. With $19,000 cash to pay the $3.5 million debt they'd run up. And those airheads thought they were in a position to sit in judgment on the way I rescued the mess they had created. I may be the only preacher in America that knows that there's a war going on. And the most stupid of nations recognize when war comes, if they can't do it themselves, they import somebody to put the soldiers through a boot camp. And the first thing they got to get out of their system is this demon called fairness. There is no cancer that destroys anything like these little, usually it's some little old quiet wimp. Notice that. Some little old quiet wimp that loves to sit around. It's like a boisterous man with a quiet woman. Look out. It's very apparent who runs the house. And these little wimps, they sit around. So I've had a rule. I established it 14 years ago, and some people have started forgetting it. That rule is, I have to deal with the decisions of who's right and wrong. And I have not had the luxury these many years of being able to say in any circumstance, well, you're 100% wrong. He's 100% right. It just never works out that way. Either he may be right, but the way he went about it was wrong. It's always on some continuum. And the task is made 1,000-fold more difficult if when you pull the contestants apart, you have to deal with that 2- and 3-year-old mentality. Well, he hit me first. Well, he pushed me harder than I pushed him. So I have a rule. You turn your 2% into 100%. And you turn your 98% into 100%. When I come on the scene, since I take the responsibility around here, and there's conflict, each guy's 100% wrong. Then it's my job to say, no, you're not quite 100% wrong, bring you up to a proper level. And no, you're not quite 100% wrong, just 99.9%. So. Do you understand the difference? But ego and self being what it is when people backslide, invariably I begin to see it in that excuse-making and posterior covering behavior. And instead of saying, it's me, O Lord, standing in need of prayer. They start playing cement mouth mind games on you. As though if they don't respond, somebody will, out of the woodwork, come up with a rescue attitude. A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. I don't tolerate it. That's why I get on you sometimes. Those that have watched me for 14 years have seen me. I've never, ever chewed anybody out or publicly embarrassed them in the sanctuary without giving them a warning first. You ever seen an exception? But they're too dumb to pick up on the warning. Well, once I start that process, it's absolute. They're either going to pick up on the warning or a bomb's going to drop on them. There's no other way you maintain control. Watch, a dirty word, not in my vocabulary. Whether I'm teaching in college or preaching in the church, I'm in charge of that house. We don't vote on the rules. You play with my rules. I'm accountable to God for what goes on in that house. You aren't. If I come to your house, I play with your house rules. And ironically, and to some people's amazement, I'm a very good guest. I never presume on anyone. I never get on to you Voices of Faith. I never get on to you King's Houses without a warning first. I always come in here. And when Satan has made his points with some fool like Jim Baker, I will talk in code to you for days. And if you would listen to the cues, we could go through the crisis time talking in code. There's enough of you that are taught by me that if you would respond during one of those crisis times when the devil's got a little bit of an edge because of some fool, I could meet our budget and never use the word budget. I could raise the funds and never, ever have a person going by who wasn't a regular know it was happening. But you won't pick up on the cues. And then the very same people, because you won't pick up on the cues, that drive me for all of our sakes, because we are called to this work together, that drive me to doing what I have to do, as Moses repeatedly did with a recalcitrant people, you then do what you could have done when you first heard the code. I came tonight sick. I feel pretty good right now. The people in, I don't want any applause. The people in here know why. But I came here tonight. I threw a cue to you. I didn't need to spend the whole evening here. Last night I came for intending to stay an hour, and the devil attacked. And we lost the first hour because of a satellite interference. Tonight I gave you your cues when I first sat down. And you didn't pick up on them. I mean, how many nights you're supposed to sit there? You had Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. There are hundreds of people looking at me that know you made a commitment back there somewhere that at least one or two nights a week you would treat it as a work night. And you would attack these phones as though you alone had the job. And you know I'm telling you the truth, and you've breached your agreement. Tell me where I've breached my agreements with the church. Like Samuel, I can stand here. I said, we're starting over. In this my 15th year, if there are people who work with me, associate with me, or in this church, and can't remember the principles that have been laid down on which we are building, I'm going to remind you in such a painful way. You'll either shape up or get out. My staff is going to learn if they don't remember the ground rules, I do. I don't need a referee. I don't need some hotshot peanut sitting around trying to decide who's the most right. When I'm on the battlefield trying to get a job done with 40 million potential homes out there, and I have to pause in the midst of getting to the bottom of what's going wrong, I have to pause and fight down somebody's ego who doesn't want to say, I goofed. Now, I will eliminate everybody. I did a few weeks ago. I want this place full of voices of faith. But I got that uncanny ability to feel when a referee sits down in here. Grandparents, you know, who sit in judgment on the way that their kids raise their kids. Any of you ever had that experience? You're having to deal with your kids. Of course, your mama slapped your head off. But she walks in and you're paddling her little grandkid. You ever feel that psychological pressure? Well, Grandma can take a walk. Long walk. And never turn around. We have new people that come all the time. They think that God just spit this place into existence. Well, God was on his throne 15 years ago when it was on the skids. And the airhead referees were up in the crow's nest. I don't know where the airhead referees are. They ain't here anymore. I never heard of them since either. They ain't doing much. When they get to heaven and God says, what did you do the last 15 years? For me, God speaking. My dog Bosco's done more. Now, I'm not done tonight, but neither are you. When are you going to learn out there? Hey, every time I've chewed into you, every time I've left this chair empty, I've thrown cues that a blind walrus, dead asleep, could catch. Now, somewhere you've got to get out of boot camp and kindergarten and start being a fellow warrior with me in this fight of faith, because there is a war going on. And maybe in tonight's news, you need to be reminded of the scripture of what's going to happen when everybody says peace and safety. You see, while the music plays, many times, this little microphone is turned off for you, but I'm talking to my cameramen and directors and sound people and shaders and VTR men and engineers, and they hear every word that I say. And many times in the heat of the battle, I have to deal with a problem, and I demand an explanation. Well, the explanation is anybody that was involved in it better start saying, I goofed real quick, because we haven't got time for sensitive egos. That's what boot camp's about. Because when you're out in the field and the shells are flying and the sergeant says move, he hasn't got time to say please. Christianity had better figure out we're at war. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. I cannot afford anybody on my staff. I cannot afford anybody in this room. And I really can't afford to have an evening without King's Houses out there, compensating for those I can't control who don't know we're at war. If you just get your body in here and don't understand that we have, come 9 o'clock tonight, engaged the forces of hell, you're a fool. There is a difference between you doing what the Lord has you do and this engagement for battle that goes on here every night. We connect a network of faith penetrating the territory or the turf of the prince of the power of the air. Where do you think gangs get their evil ideas? Who do you think spawns that attitude? I mean, the same thing happens every night at 9 o'clock on a much grander scale. If you've seen the movie Bears, and I don't understand anything about invading a bear's space. You see it in horses. You see it in dogs who mark their territory. We are invading the devil's turf. I mean, you may have worked all day today as a servant of the Lord. You may be under his care. You have family responsibilities, individual responsibilities. You bring your body through the traffic, worn out and irritated, get home. Come 9 o'clock, if you're part of this committed company, we suddenly have invaded the devil's turf. The prince of the power of the air. This ain't no ordinary ministry. Most people who study gangs will tell you they're under normal circumstances. An ordinary person can walk through their territory unless they are, you know, determined to hit somebody and rob them or commit a crime and you happen to be the victim in the area, but normally you can go through their territory and not be bothered. But another gang member going through that turf knows it's their turf, and thus the very presence of that gang member is a challenge, a declaration of war. It is a knowledgeable intrusion into turf territory. And the turf's got to be protected. There's war. Even gangs sometimes feel like they're unfairly treated because they don't attack everybody. They attack the members of other gangs or whom they perceive to be invading their turf. There are other people who can go on television. Don't bother the devil. I mean, they're neutral people. We're more like the police invading the turf, not another gang. We know where the devil has his colors. And we're going with all seven of them raised. Whether you know it or not, I am. And if you're in my car, so to speak, you better be ready too. Or you're going to get your asteroid burned. Stay off the territory or come ready to do battle. That's why I tell you, get on the telephone. Don't sit down there and say, okay, Gene, what do you got for me tonight? Pipe and a beer. I got seven right in your face. That's what I got. You're either for me or against me. Either get with it or get out of the way. Now get on the telephone. Oh, yeah. All right. You don't have to take any more calls. Now I'm going to finish what I started. Within a few years after the appearance of Tyndale's New Testament, the Church of England had wakened to the needs of the time and carried in convocation 1534 a petition for an English translation of the Scriptures. We may well believe that the influence of Tyndale's version had a good deal to do with this improved attitude. In 1535, the very year of Tyndale's imprisonment, came the Bible of Miles Coverdale, afterwards Bishop of Exeter, the man who, after Tyndale, has played the most prominent part of any in the history of the English Bible. Coverdale was a man of very different stamp from his great predecessor. He had neither his ability nor strength of character, nor was he, like him, fitted by a lifelong study for his task as a translator. And the difference comes markedly out in the work produced by each. Coverdale was a man of sympathetic nature and fine literary instinct, and the attractive English of his translation has considerably influenced the language of the Authorized Version. His Bible makes no pretense to be an original translation. It is translated out of Dutch or German and Latin into English with the help of five sundry interpreters, that is, translators. And the chief of these interpreters is evidently William Tyndale, whom in the New Testament especially he closely follows. Now, Tyndale's was a New Testament. In our museum we'll have maybe the only one, black letter edition, of Tyndale's New Testament. Now, a lot of people thought that he translated the Pentateuch, but went no further. We have no proof, though. For years, it was said, until Francis Fry, the famed expert on Tyndale, uncovered and wrote this authentication of the only copy of Joshua translated by Tyndale in existence. This is it, the only one, which you'll get a chance to feast your eyes on at our new home, with his own notes, as he was so prone to put in the margin. What happened when Coverdale went to work is he essentially adopted Tyndale's New Testament with some phraseology change, and come on over, Brad. And then from the German, give me the two, no, just the one back, that's Matthews, the big Coverdale, that's it, that's it. From the German, that is, borrowing largely from Luther and Jerome's Vulgate, Coverdale did what's called the first whole Bible in English, but in essence, his Old Testament was not from the original, but from the German and the Latin. But it was the first whole Bible. But in spite of the hatred for Tyndale, it is Tyndale's New Testament that comprises most of the Coverdale Bible. The following year, 1537, appeared Matthew's Bible, which was really prepared by John Rogers, one of the early reformers and an associate of Tyndale, afterward martyred in Queen Mary's reign. His known opinions and his connections with Tyndale accounts for the supposition that his real name would likely endure the circulation of the book, so they called it Matthew's, but it was John Rogers. The work was Tyndale's translation, pure and simple, all but the latter half of the Old Testament, which is taken with some alteration from the Coverdale Bible. So Coverdale took Tyndale's New Testament, but translated from the German and Latin his Old Testament. Rogers, who had access to the Old Testament translations of Wycliffe, Tyndale, which included the Pentateuch, and no doubt he had access to Joshua, and possibly some later work, he therefore relied upon Tyndale for the Pentateuch and the early part of the Old Testament, retaining Coverdale shrunken down for the second half of the Old Testament, so to speak. So Tyndale ends up dominating the New Testament of the Coverdale Bible, the New Testament and the Pentateuch and early portions of the Old Testament and Matthew's Bible. I got it in two volumes over here, the Matthew's Bible. This is the New Testament portion of Matthew's Bible. Which is simply Tyndale. Some phraseology change, but essentially the translation is Tyndale's. And the Old Testament, which the first half of which is primarily Tyndale, and the second half is the work that Coverdale did. This is the Matthew's Bible. A very rare and nicely bound copy of both the Old and the New Testament. So we'll be able to trace through examples, Mr. Houghton here, the development of the English Bible. The work was, Matthew's that is, Tyndale's translation, pure and simple, all but the latter half of the Old Testament, which is taken with some alteration from Coverdale's Bible. And one feels pleased for the old exile Tyndale's sake, though his honor was given to others, that Archbishop Cranmer should, quote, concerning this Matthew's Bible, like it better than any translation heretofore made. He would rather see it licensed by the king than receive £1,000. And if they waited till the bishop should set forth a better translation, they would wait, he said, till the day after doomsday. It is not easy to understand how it escaped detection as the work of Tyndale, especially as it contained many of those strong anti-clerical notes by which Tyndale's version gave such offense. None of these versions were satisfactory. Coverdale's was a second-hand translation, and Matthew's was only in part derived from the originals, besides which the controversial notes still coming from Tyndale argued against its success, so it came to pass that the Great Bible was set on foot with the church. Archbishop Cranmer and some of the chief advisors of the king had set their hearts on having a translation that would be really worthy of its position as a national Bible. Miles Coverdale, who had produced the Coverdale Bible, was selected to take charge of the work, and he proceeded to Paris with the king's printer, that the book might be brought out in the best possible style. But the Inquisitor General of the Inquisition of the Roman Catholic Church, even though England had broken, and Henry was serving as king of both France and England, the Inquisitor General got notice of the project, and the result was a repetition of the episode of Tyndale at Cologne. Only the Coverdale fared better than his great predecessor Tyndale, who escaped with a few pages. For Coverdale, though his Bibles were all seized by the lieutenant criminal, Coverdale carried off the printing press, the types, and the printers themselves to complete the work in England. Now, that's the way to do it. It was published in April 1539 and was authorized to be used and frequented in every church in the kingdom. But more important to notice is the fact the book is really no new translation. It may be described as a compilation from Matthew's and Coverdale's Bible, or better still, as a revision of Matthew's Bible by Coverdale. But since, as we've seen, Matthew's was almost entirely Tyndale's version, the Great Bible was really little more than a revised version of Tyndale. Thus had the old martyr triumphed. These men had opposed him to the very day of his death, and now here was his Bible in their midst, though they knew it not, authorized by the king, commended by the clergy, and placed in the parish churches for the teaching of the people. And as if to mark the change with all the emphasis that was possible, an inscription on the title page told that, quote, it was overseen and perused with the commandment of the King's Highness by the Right Reverend Fathers of God, Cuthbert, Bishop of Derisma, or Durham, and Nicholas, Bishop of Rochester. Now, who do you think was this Cuthbert of Derisma? None other than Cuthbert Tonstall, Tyndale's untiring opponent, the bishop who had turned him discouraged from his door, who had bargained with Packington to purchase his Bibles, who had hurled into the flames from the pulpit of Paul's Cross the translation which now went forth with his own name on its title page. God has his ways, doesn't he? Now, go over there and get me those two samples of the Great Bible. Here is a bound small folio version of the Great Bible, which will be in our library. And the folio leaves, I have some sections here tonight which show the pulpit small folio style with the title page. I've got to be careful with these leaves. Having purchased a leaf, I know how valuable leaves are. But this is an intact section for the Great Bible, much like the section of Daniel that just sold in Sotheby's for the Gutenberg, although this is the Great Bible. Here's a bound section of the Great Bible. Book of Job from out of the Great Bible. You can open these up. I am out over there. As you can open some of those pages and lay it over there. This very rare small quarto is no mean addition to our library at the University Cathedral. But thus came about the Great Bible. To follow the Great Bible will come the Geneva, translated at Zurich, or rather at Geneva in Switzerland, and put together there. We have a first edition from Geneva and the first edition when it was reprinted in Britain, which became the Bible of the Puritans and the Pilgrims. As popular in its day as the King James, with comments mostly Calvinistic because of the Puritan theological leanings, an attempt to improve upon it was the Bishop's Bible, in which the Queen herself appointed a committee of bishops to improve upon the Geneva version, and it could never compete with the Geneva. And then came the famous King James and the committees that were put together under James I to produce it. And we showed you first editions of that last night. I think we're going to have a nice museum, don't you? Yes, sir. Get on telephone.